It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, a new report indicates graduation rates are up in Pittsburgh public schools. The achievement gap continues, but also a puzzling situation. Why do two schools with similar demographics in their student populations perform so differently? And it's light up night in Pittsburgh, the start of the holiday season. Activities range from tree lightings to nationality rooms in the Cathedral of Learning to ice skating in Market Square to the Phipps Flower Show. But first, Allegheny County jail officials have faced heavy criticism in recent years for everything from how mental health services are provided to inmates to a higher than average suicide rate among prisoners, and more recently, how pregnant inmates and transgender prisoners are treated. Are there similar concerns in other lockups across the state? We're going to discuss this with Rich Lord, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the program, Rich.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
And joining us by phone is Samantha Mullamed, a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Daily News, and Philly.com. Welcome, Samantha.
Thanks for having me.
As always, your participation is encouraged. Tweet us your questions or comments and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Samantha, I want to start with you. I referenced some of the challenges, problems the Allegheny County Jail has been dealing with, mental health of inmates to a higher suicide rate than the national average, to policies for pregnant inmates. So in your coverage, have you found any similar problems elsewhere? Does it vary from county to county and even from the level of incarceration, you know, a county jail compared to a state prison?
I mean, I think many of the problems that that are being faced are pretty similar across the state. Certainly the use of solitary confinement is something that happens in the Philadelphia jails as well as in the state system. And I've, you know, heard indirectly about challenges around mental health treatment and also the health care that's provided. There have been suicides reported in the Philadelphia jails as well.
So, Rich, many of the complaints from family members and advocates for inmates and other concerned parties regarding the Allegheny County Jail date back to when Corizon Health was hired to provide health services for the inmates. Again, remind us, who is Corizon? Why were they brought in, a private contractor, et cetera?
Yeah, first let me say that health care in a jail is not easy under any circumstances, but prior to 2013, it was handled by a nonprofit agency that the county itself had created to do that. And then there was a perception that the quality of care wasn't that good, death rates were higher than national averages, and the costs seemed to be high. So the county decided to bid it out, and they hired a Tennessee-based firm called Corizon, which handles, I believe, more than 100 correctional facilities, handles the medical care in more than 100 correctional facilities. Corizon lasted, I believe, 2 years, during which there was continuous problems with getting the right medication to the right inmates, with keeping psychiatric doctors and other physicians on staff, with turnover on the staff, with mental health care. And after a couple of years of Corizon, the county decided, okay, we're not going to renew these guys. And they've worked since then with Allegheny Health Network, sort of a hybrid county slash hospital arrangement to take care of the sick inmates.
Mm. Samantha, how are health services provided in lockups and prisons in the Philly area? Are there any private contractors?
You know, it's not really something that I've covered a lot.
Okay, so let me ask about something that has come up, and it's mental health services. Are they being downplayed by jail and prison officials? Are they under-resourced? Are they difficult to spot? Let's start with you, Samantha. Just in general, the mental health services and how they're provided and any challenges.
Well, I mean, I guess one of the challenges is just that because there are so few community-based services available, a lot of people dealing with mental health issues do end up in jails and in prisons, just often for crimes that may be, you know, resulting from their mental health problems. And in the Philadelphia jails, you know, when someone has a suicide threat, you know, or a suicide attempt, one of the things that happens is that they're transferred to a mental health unit where they may be held in solitary, they may be in a cell wearing with nothing but a suicide smock, which is essentially like almost like a sleeping bag with armholes that you wear, and you really have nothing else in there with you, which is to protect you from yourself. But you can imagine that's not very good for someone's mental health.
Taking care of the mentally ill has really changed over the last couple of years. There are only two forensic mental hospital units in the whole state now. One's in Westmoreland County at Torrance, and the other one is out near Philadelphia at Norristown. So there's now a backup. If you're an inmate, if you're in jail, and you have obvious mental health problems, you're supposed to be transferred to a mental hospital for after a week in order to get the necessary treatment so you're competent to go to trial. But because there are so few mental health beds left, people are sitting for months in jails, both here and out in Philadelphia, to the point where the ACLU had to sue the state in order to get more beds open.
And that's, but was that enough?
No, it's still not resolved.
Is there still a backlog?
There's still a backlog on both ends of the state. And as a result, if you have a severe mental illness and you're in jail because you committed almost trivial nonviolent crime, you may sit in solitary confinement in a jail for weeks or months, which clearly doesn't help you.
Samantha, have you covered that, and particularly specific mental health issues of prisoners?
Yeah, well, in the state system, this is something that also was subject to a lawsuit, and the state actually worked with, I believe it was the Justice Department a few years ago, because they were holding people with mental illness in solitary for a very long time, and they had to do a series of reforms and improve the mental health units and add mental health beds. So in the state system, supposedly we are seeing some improvement, but I'm not sure how widely that extends to the county jails.
Is there a processing, and we're going to talk a little bit later about suicide rates and prevention efforts, but is there a processing for just a immediate screening of an inmate as they enter the system or not? Rich?
When you come into Allegheny County Jail, right, almost immediately you get an interview with a professional whose job is to kind of ask you the right questions to suss out whether you have any suicidal ideas. And you're not supposed to be given a cell of your own during the early stages of your incarceration. But there have been exceptions. There are some inmates who might be perceived as dangerous or sick who've ended up with cells of their own shortly after they were incarcerated, and that's where you end up seeing the suicides. People who are really serious about suicide aren't always in a hurry to tell anybody about it. If they really want to do it, then they're probably going to keep quiet.
Anything about the mental health screening process in the Philadelphia area or in the state prison system that stands out to you, Samantha?
It's not something that I know that much about, but you know, I've definitely heard from people who, I guess I would say that, you know, some of the practices that take place once people are in prison, particularly young people who are charged and held as adults, can be, you know, sound pretty damaging to mental health. And I've heard from young people who have attempted their own lives while they were in solitary confinement. I just pulled the numbers for 2016. Juveniles held as adults were held in segregation 72 times last year for an average of 34 days. So it's a long time to be sitting in a cell alone.
You've been working on this issue of solitary and particularly with juveniles, have you not?
Yes.
So what stands out to you? You mentioned a little bit. Tell us a little more.
I think a lot of people believe that solitary confinement is something that is cruel and unusual. And sort of could be considered psychological torture for many. But in Pennsylvania, the ACLU reported that about 100 people are on a semi-permanent restricted release list who've been in solitary confinement, some of them for decades. And here, you know, around the state, it's been made illegal to hold juveniles in solitary confinement. But what I've heard from advocates and attorneys is that, you know, like there are ways around that where a juvenile could be sort of in a room with an unlocked door, for example, and they, you know, but they can't leave the room, and that's not considered solitary, but it still can have a similar effect for kids.
Rich.
A couple years ago, the state of Pennsylvania reached a settlement in a lawsuit, and essentially what it said was that the most serious mentally ill inmates, which is about 8% of the inmate population, will no longer go to your standard solitary confinement for punishment. And solitary in the state system means 23 hours in a cell, sometimes with a cellmate, sometimes by yourself, 1 hour out per day. But there's a larger population of inmates, nearly a quarter of the inmates, who are considered mentally ill but not, quote, seriously mentally ill. And a lot of those folks end up in solitary confinement. Their last count were about 1,200 inmates in the entire state system, which is about a 48,000 inmate system, who were in solitary confinement. And there's no limit in Pennsylvania to the amount of time you can spend in solitary. In Colorado last month, the superintendent of prisons said nobody is going to be in solitary for more than 15 days at a stretch, period. Texas is phasing out solitary. California is significantly reducing its population in solitary. Pennsylvania has not to date seriously dented its solitary population.
Samantha, I was reading a story that you did sort of focused on an outsider's point of view about policies toward inmates. It was the warden from a prison in Norway. And one of the things that stood out to me in your reporting was the comments made regarding solitary confinement, what he saw here as compared to Norway.
Yeah, I mean, solitary confinement doesn't exist in Norway, neither do life sentences. So that's one of many differences. Also, Norway's entire country, which is 5.2 million people, has 3,900 prisoners. And just Philadelphia alone in our jail, we have almost double that. So, you know, it's a very different system with a different focus. And, you know, they don't believe that you should punish people while they're in prison. They believe going to prison is itself punishment.
Allegheny County recently adopted a new comprehensive policy regarding pregnant inmates. The ACLU filed suit against the county last December, alleging cruel and unusual punishment of five women who were placed in solitary, once again coming up solitary again, for minor infractions. Attorney Dave Fawcett is a lawyer with Reed Smith. He worked on the case, and he was pleased with the settlement with the county.
It's a good comprehensive policy in any, and you know, across the country, this problem exists, and a lot of jails and prisons don't have a policy that applies to how pregnant women should be treated.
Rich, I believe the county says the jail had already changed its policy before this agreement was reached.
Yeah, the jail's been under pressure for its treatment of pregnant inmates for quite a while. As you'll remember, there were times when pregnant inmates had to be shackled during labor when they were brought to the hospital. But then that policy was changed after there was a lot of pressure from advocates. And when advocates here saw that pregnant women were ending up in solitary for things like having two pairs of shoes when you're only supposed to have one in your cell, that prompted a lawsuit. Whether the county changed its policy before or after the lawsuit, I can't say for certain. But we do find that where inmate welfare is concerned, usually the county changes when there's outside pressure.
We alluded to suicides, and there were two in the Allegheny County Jail last year, and I believe three so far this year. Samantha, I want to start with you on the issue of suicides. What have you found out about suicides in the prison system in the eastern part of the state, and any particular steps to prevent them?
Well, as I mentioned before, the preventative step that I know about is the removal to the mental health unit, which involves segregation, which involves being held in a suicide smock. You know, it's something that has come up in the jails on and off, but it's not something that's been a lot on the radar recently.
Yeah, we've seen in Allegheny County Jail higher than average suicide rates for probably more than a decade now, and continue to document that. And I think that right now, the problem ties in a little bit to the opioid epidemic, because so many of your incoming inmates are going through withdrawal. There's not medication-assisted withdrawal in the jail as there is outside. And so you're really plunging into kind of the depths of physical and mental despair at the time you're incarcerated. The the only way to deal with that, of course, is both removing physical hazards that you might hang yourself from, and also just checking a lot on each inmate to see whether there's anything unusual going on, whether they might need to talk about something. And that's been an ongoing problem, challenge.
In our remaining minute, I want to get an answer from both of you. Samantha, what are you looking forward to, and what can we expect to read from you in the future regarding the overall issue of prisons and health of inmates, et cetera?
Right. Well, I think here in Philadelphia, they're really working to try to reduce the population and to look at ways of turning away from holding so many people in jail, which is something that we've struggled with for a couple decades now. So one thing that I'm working on right now is a story about just the generations that are incarcerated together and what that looks like and how that affects the neighborhoods that are sort of depleted as the adult male population is off in prison.
And Rich?
The state claims that it is in the process of reviewing its use of solitary confinement across the board, not just for seriously mentally ill inmates, but for everybody. We're going to try to, hold them to that and see what comes of that process. And locally, we'll be very interested to see how the Allegheny County Jail, which is essentially now a mental health and drug rehabilitation facility, adjusts to that role.
Rich Lohr is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Samantha Malamed is a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Daily News, and Philly.com. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it, Kevin.
Coming up, how is the Pittsburgh School District addressing persistent challenges over achievement disparities? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. State legislators are battling over which salamander will become the state's official amphibian. The Senate approved a bill this week designating the eastern hellbender, a species with a shrinking population. Though now House Republican leader Dave Reed is seeking support for legislation backing a different kind of salamander. And locals will flood downtown tonight for the annual Light Up Night festivities. Last year's event brought an estimated 300,000 visitors. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh education advocacy group A-Plus Schools released its annual report Monday, analyzing performance in Pittsburgh public schools. The district's graduation rate increased to 80%, and now more than half of third graders are reading at grade level. But the report did find disparities continue between black and white students' achievement. The executive director of A-Plus, James Fogarty, echoed city leaders describing Pittsburgh as a city split in two. Joining us in studio, education reporters Molly Bourne with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and 90.5 WESA, Sarah Schneider. Welcome back to the program, both of you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet them using hashtag WESAConfluence.
And so let us not be disheartened by the data that we might see in terms of gaps. Because we know there are schools that are getting the job done with black and white and Latino and Asian students in this district, and they're getting it done across all neighborhoods of this city.
That was the executive director of the city school's leading advocacy organization, A-Plus Schools, James Fogarty. He's talking about an achievement gap between what he sees as two types of schools, one getting high test scores and fewer student suspensions. The other isn't performing so well. Student scores are failing. They aren't coming to class. And when they do come, suspension rates are high. So, Molly, Sarah, what's going on here? I mean, we see some positive news, but we also still see some lingering and persistent negatives. Let's start with you, Molly.
Sure. So, I do think we see... I looked back in some of our archives and noticed the same themes, that there are some schools that are doing quite well within PPS, others not so much. I heard that echoed again in the report on Monday. I thought it was especially interesting that James Fogarty chose to highlight a couple of schools. He mentioned two, like one they're serving a similar population, right? One's doing well and one's not.
Right.
Why is that? And I think that we're still trying to answer that question. I was chatting with him earlier, and he emphasized that, you know, that it's not, the parents and magnets and traditional schools, they both are 100%, you know, devoted to kids in the schools, but there's lots of other factors at play.
Right. The two schools that he pointed out in particular, Allegheny Traditional, which is a K-5 and a magnet, and Langley K-8 in Sheridan. Sarah.
Yeah, so he pointed out, I think he was trying to make the point that we can be successful in the public school district. And this is what one district is doing. Their reading scores at third grade were much higher than Allegheny's. The magnet school is much higher than Langley. And he made the point at the end that, you know, they've had the same principal for many years. And so there's a little stability there. I mean, Allegheny is a magnet, but it's a lottery system. So there's not a whole lot different there than the two schools. And like Molly said, they're serving about the same population.
Right. So Allegheny, 72% of African-American students read at grade level last year. At Langley, only 17% of the black students could. Is that a fair comparison? You mentioned magnet to a quote, regular public school. So is that a fair comparison of the two, since one is a magnet and one is not?
Right. It was the third grade reading level is what they're looking at, which is known as a benchmark year you're looking
right.
at if you can continue learning from there. I think it is a fair comparison. With magnets, there is a difference. Their students are held to a little bit higher standard just as in terms of attendance. You have to be at school 90% of days in the year. But other than that, it's a lottery system. So it could reflect parent involvement just because there's an application process, but that's really drawing something out of that.
Okay. Molly, so did the report, what are they saying? Do they have any idea what are the dividing issues of why this might be the case that one school, the kids in Allegheny, the Allegheny Magnet, are doing much better than the kids at Langley in the third grade?
One issue that's huge in any school is stability. If you have principal turnover, for example, or high teacher turnover, which we can talk about later, it that affects how kids learn. Stability is crucial. And I think you can take those schools, for example, there's been a lot of principal stability, for example, at Allegheny Traditional, So that would suggest that would be like a potentially a big one, but it's also like it's so hard to tell as well.
So that's sort of anecdotal rather than a lot of data on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Well, you mentioned teacher turnover, so let's go there. Let's start. What is the process to allow teachers? How can teachers, and we're talking about teachers moving within the district, the same district, moving from one school to another. What's the process? Are they just allowed to? How quickly are they allowed to? Seniority? How's it work?
Yeah, that's actually something that's come up during contract negotiations, which are ongoing between the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers and the school district. The school district wants to change it from teachers being able to move after a year to every 3 years to sort of increase the likelihood that a school will remain stable in their view, that like it's after 1 year you can leave and people do.
So it would be a 3-year minimum stay at a school. Is that what
that's
I'm
my
saying?
Understanding? That, okay. Yeah, but that is a sticking point in, or that is, I guess, a point that has come up during contract negotiations. The PFT wants it to stay at 1 year, I believe that they're worried about like the resentment that might come if teachers are sort of being required to stay at a
right.
school longer than they want,
or right. that they might leave the district entirely.
Well, that's what we traditionally hear about teacher turnover. In fact, I remember it was about a little over a year ago, we were talking about teacher turnover in the Pittsburgh Public Schools and nationwide, and there was a study by the U.S. Department of Education. It said that 1 in 10 teachers leave the industry in their after their first year, and that number goes up to 1 in 6 before 4 years. So it's not just moving from, you know, urban inner city school to a charter to a suburban. It's just plain leaving the business.
During negotiations, while it wasn't a sticking point, there were some conversations about how do we encourage teachers to work in our schools that need them the most, because the movement that we see is in the hardest to staff schools, and those are the district's focus and priority schools. That's a designation that the state gives, essentially, you know, schools that are struggling. We know what some of these schools are. Westinghouse, for example, would be among the focus and priority schools, and so the PFT wanted to have like a meeting essentially where they could have conversations about this, and I'll be interested to see what results from those conversations in time, separate from negotiations.
Yeah, part of the A Plus Schools report was also a survey of teachers saying if they're satisfied at their school, and so that is in the report. You can find that school by school online. Overall, teachers said they were, but that is a concern of how do we keep them at that level.
Yeah, and as far as the stability issue and contract negotiations, I mean, what incentives could they the district offer, or how to encourage teachers to stay where they are and things could get better because of stability, increased stability? What can they do? Is it just monetary incentives, something else?
I think some people have done that in other districts. We don't do that here within Pittsburgh Public, but those are exactly the kind of conversations that a lot of players here want to be having.
Okay. But the news isn't all bad or all discouraging. Pittsburgh's graduation rate rose by 10 percentage points to 80% overall for the class of 2017. Do we know if there's much of a variance from one high school to another? Is it pretty steady across the board? Because I looked it up in Philadelphia Public Schools, they're 67% district-wide, but that ranges from 52% in one school all the way up to 96%. Do we know if there's a big variance in Pittsburgh high schools?
Yeah, Pittsburgh Perry has the lowest graduation rate. That's on the north side, and they're at 72% graduated last year. And then the highest is Kappa. That's the arts performing arts school downtown, and their graduation rate is 96%. Other than that, it's in the high 80s, low 90%. And so, yeah, doing better than statewide, definitely. That's a point of celebration that A-plus highlighted.
And it's getting closer. Pittsburgh's getting closer to the statewide average. I think the statewide average is somewhere around in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. So my final question, and I'll be curious to what you're working on regarding the Pittsburgh School District. And it's a two-parter. That and also, how has the superintendent reacted to this news? So we'll start with you, Molly, and then Sarah.
The superintendent spoke on Monday after the presentation that A-plus Schools gave, and he emphasized that, you know, that yes, there are some kids who aren't doing well, and there are some kids who are doing really well. And I think that's kind of that theme that we see emerging. As for stories that I'm following, I'm going to be interested to see what happens with the teacher's contract. Yesterday, the executive board of the union took a vote to reject the independent arbitrator's findings as to what to do about the future contract. The district, or the school board, rather, wanted to approve it. Now they're going to go back to the negotiations table. That'll be really interesting, starting after Thanksgiving.
And Sarah, you've been working on community schools.
Yeah, community schools is definitely something I am interested in following. Also, suspensions, you know, this report showed what we knew, that suspensions did go down a little bit, but there's still this disparity in who is being suspended more often between Black and white students. And our Superintendent Anthony Hamlet did mention that this achievement gap starts at birth is what he noted. And so he did make a call that this can't just be on the district, that other people have to work on this. He noted one option would be universal pre-K, which was in the mayor's budget. So that's something that I think was important, an important takeaway from.
Yeah, quickly, Molly.
I'll note, too, we have a new school board coming in January. Yeah. So I'll be interested to see what some of the new members, what they're going to be focusing on. We have Salu Dean representing District 3. Veronica Edwards will be replacing Carolyn Klug.
District 9.
Yeah. I'm missing anyone?
That's it.
Okay.
All right. And they'll have some big issues to tackle. Molly Bourne is education reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Sarah Schneider covers schools and education for WESA. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, ready or not, the holiday season kicks off, or should I say light up today in Pittsburgh. What's next on the Confluence? That's what's happening on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Heinz History Center opens the Western Pennsylvania Sports Museum in 2004. The multi-story exhibit pays homage to the greats of the Pittsburgh region, from high school football to the city's top boxers. It includes artifacts from the Steelers, Pirates, and Penguins, as well as 70 hands-on exhibits. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for November 17th, 2017.
It's the confluence where the news comes together, and for right now, where the holidays come together. I'm Kevin Gavin. You can pick your Yuletide poison. We've got tree lightings, the nationality rooms at Pitt's Cathedral of Learning, ice skating in Market Square, the Phipps Annual Flower Show, even bird counting. And we don't mean a partridge in a pear tree or even two turtle doves. It all starts now. Tonight is Light Up Night, which traditionally kicks off the Christmas season in the Pittsburgh area. We're going to talk about all the upcoming festivities and a bit about their history with Rosalind Colgan, food and culture editor with The Incline. Rosalind, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Bobby Cherry, news editor for the Sewickley Herald. Welcome to you as well, sir.
Thank you for having me here today.
And we invite you to join the conversation by tweeting a question or comment and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. Light Up Night, for folks who've never been or tend to avoid the crowds, what can we expect to see?
You know, it's a very crowded night. It's cold, but that won't mean that people stay away. There's, I think, usually 300,000 people in the city. It's the biggest party in the city, and it's going to be a great night of festive Santas everywhere and Christmas lights and tree lightings all over the place.
You know, we actually looked into the history of Light Up Night because we were wondering why it's so early. It happens before we even carve our turkeys. And believe it or not, Light Up Night actually even used to be earlier. So it started in 1959, and it was in April.
April. Why?
So it actually was not for the holiday season, of course, but every light in the Golden Triangle was turned on until midnight, and there were spotlights and a parade. It was all in celebration of the Pirates season. And then the next year in 1960, it went on to become a holiday tradition, and ever since then, we've had Light Up Night.
Okay, but there was a suspension for, I believe, 9 years, and it had to do with the energy crisis. So why was it brought back?
It was an attempt to raise some more morale during the steel industry collapse. It was brought back in 1982, and we've had it every year since then, and it's been growing every year. As Bobby mentioned, it's packed downtown now.
All right. So, Bobby, it might not be too early for you, but I'll ask this to both of you. Why the Friday before Thanksgiving? Isn't that a little early for this? Well, maybe not for you personally, Bobby.
Is it ever too early to celebrate Christmas? You know, it's the start. Next weekend is Black Friday, of course, Thanksgiving weekend. And it's sort of that pre-kickoff to getting everything going in the city. The Saturday after Thanksgiving is the annual Christmas parade in town.
Right.
So it sort of sets off the rest of the season. You have to start it early because there's not a lot of time to celebrate.
Rosalind, too early for you?
Well, you know, Bobby is basically Santa himself. I mean, he loves Christmas so much. He has been counting down since July, I'm pretty sure. For me, maybe a little early. I'm one of those people who likes to just keep Thanksgiving in November and then start Christmas in December. But, you know, we'll let it pass. And Pittsburghers actually have been complaining about this for decades. So.
Well, you two make a compromise. will be you get to celebrate Thanksgiving, and then you can start it with the Christmas parade the Saturday after. Will you make
Fair
that
enough.
Compromise?
That's a good that compromise. Yeah.
Okay. So the crowds have grown. They weren't all that big, but they have grown. But I assume the festivities have grown as well. It's more and more each year or what?
That's
Plus
right.
fireworks. Can't have a Pittsburgh holiday without fireworks.
Absolutely. You've got to have fireworks in Pittsburgh no matter what the holiday. But the holiday market is one of the really special things that's been added in the past few years. This is in Market Square put on by the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. You'll see little chalets in Market Square, a great place to do some holiday shopping.
All right, I want to get both of your favorite things to do or favorite events, but I'm going to tell you mine. And it was as a kid, I went to the then Buell Science Center for you know what, the model train, the miniature railroad and village display. Today it's up basically year round for except for several weeks for, I believe, maintenance. And of course, it's at the Carnegie Science Center. So. Do you agree with me it's a favorite?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I spent a few years working at Carnegie Science Center, so it has a special place in my heart.
You didn't get tired of it?
I didn't. It was one of my favorite places at the museum. And this year, they've added a tiny Permane Brothers model, so that's a can't miss.
They always add something, don't they, to the display?
That's right. Each year, they add something new, a new piece of Pittsburgh history. This year's is really intricate. They have 14 tiny liquor bottles at the bar, 12 3D printed windows along the front. It took them 9 months of research. They've been working on this diligently. You can't miss it, and you can really see inside. So it feels as if you're peeking into this tiny version of the Strip District Permane's. There's even a tiny version of Tony Haggerty, who is the famed server and cook. There's, of course, only one tiny version of her because she is the one and only. So don't miss that this year.
Do you have a favorite piece of the train display down there? Something that you always look for or stare at?
I do. My favorite is the downtown scene. So you have the Bugeaud Theater. You have in the middle, there's a parade, actually, of women marching for suffrage. And let's see, they're walking past an Isley's, the theater, the shops. It's really beautiful.
Nice. All right. So I mentioned my favorite, so I'm going to give you fair turn because you said it was among your favorites. So, Bobby, what is your favorite? I'm sure Mr. Christmas has difficulty deciding, but I'm going to put you on the spot. So what is your favorite activity or event or whatever regarding the holidays and the different festivities you can take part in?
I think hands down it's the Kennywood Park Holiday Lights celebration.
Okay.
It starts Friday after Thanksgiving, and this year goes through, I think, December 30th. Mostly weekends. There's a couple weeknights after Christmas that it's up. But there's a 90-foot-tall artificial Christmas tree that goes up near Kittyland. There's a large snowman. There's a petting zoo. Some of the rides are open for guests to enjoy. And it's just a magical night of Christmas lights. I think there's something like 2 million Christmas lights around the park. And seeing it in the summer, Thunderbolt, you know, all of the great rides. But in the winter, seeing Santa Claus sitting at the racer station and you can get your picture taken with Kenny Kangaroo and Santa at the racer, I think that's just an awesome Pittsburgh memory to have.
All right. You're just a big kid in addition to being a Santa. Rosalind.
You know, one of my favorite things is buying gifts for people, and I take great pride in trying to find the right gift for somebody. So I love doing some local shopping in Pittsburgh. This year, there are more than a dozen markets where you can find local Pittsburgh-made gifts from art to plants to crafts. One of my favorites is called Handmade Arcade, and that is going to be held at the Convention Center on December 2nd. It is huge. I recommend getting there early. They have more than 170 vendors, so there's definitely something for everyone on your list there.
Okay. There are just so many things. We're not going to be able to mention even a fraction of them, but we're going to try. On display, there's a lot of things happening in Market Square throughout the holiday season, including at the around PPG Plaza, PPG Place, the annual gingerbread house display and competition.
Yeah. I was just telling Rosalind earlier, it's a great display of gingerbread houses. You know, children and groups and companies around the region create the little creations, and some of them are very, very detailed. I've seen Mr. Rogers' neighborhood trolley. I've seen Heinz Field and Minions and all sorts of great creations. And you can just get lost for hours looking at each one. I'll sometimes go alone on a Saturday afternoon in December and spend several hours looking at all of the displays and the Santa Claus, you know, figures down there and enjoying the Christmas music. They usually have live music performing down there. It's a cute display.
We have mentioned some of the traditional that I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard about, whether it's the nationality rooms at the Cathedral of Learning. But there's also on the north side of the neighborhood of Allegheny West, and these are Victorian home tours going on with what is the largest privately owned toy train collection, I believe. Yeah, so there's that, and also the Phipps Winter Flower and Light Garden. This is spectacular. Of course, this is done in the evening just so you can just take it all in.
Yeah, Phipps is extraordinary year-round, but especially during the holidays. The way that the lights play off the flowers is really exquisite. They also have some artwork nestled into the flower displays, which adds a new level of just appreciation for the flowers. It can be a little chilly. Some of the displays are outside, so get ready for that, but definitely don't miss that one.
Okay. My other favorite. So I mentioned the miniature railroad and village display, but my other favorite is something completely different, and it's been around since 1999. It is the Pittsburgh creche that is displayed at U.S. Steel Plaza. Now, this was, as I said, 99. It's the only, at the time, I'm not sure if it still is, but the only authorized replica of the creche that is in St. Peter's Square in Vatican City. And of course, this came like 10 years after the Supreme Court said, no, get rid of the nativity scene at the county courthouse. That creche just draws people walking by. It's a stopper for people passing by.
It really is. You know, usually I like to go at the celebration that they have on light up night, but this year I'm here instead. So I do try to like to make it out that afternoon when they open it for the season. Yeah.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. We're talking about light up night and how this really kicks off the holiday festivities. And we are so pleased to be joined by Bobby Cherry, news editor for the Sewickley Herald, and Rosalind Colgan, food and culture editor with the Incline. So starting next week is something as another holiday tradition, ice skating. Now, whether it's movies or photos, the visuals that we often see, Rockefeller Center, right? And their ice skating rink, they got nothing on ours, right? I think ours is two-thirds larger.
It is. Last year was it's the ice rink at PPG Place. It actually opens tonight, and public skate begins this weekend. And it's actually two-thirds larger than the rink at Rockefeller Plaza. I remember seeing Rockefeller for the first time several years back, and I thought, wow, that's actually a smaller rink than Pittsburgh. And it made me feel good, Pittsburgh proud to have that. But it's a great night of skating and seeing all of the people out there. You know, Robert Morris University will perform later this afternoon for Light Up Night. And then, of course, there's a great celebration to light the tree as well.
Yeah,
are you an ice skater?
I am. I have been doing this for years at PPG Place, and it's really beautiful. I love seeing families out there together, and sometimes you might even catch a proposal if you're lucky.
Yes.
So keep an eye out for that. It's certainly a romantic place and also a really family-friendly activity as well.
There's a new exhibit that was unveiled to the media, I believe it was yesterday, I think it's starting this weekend. It's at the Heinz History Center, and this also sort of gets nostalgic, whether it's the windows at Kaufman's and the like. Bobby.
Oh, my gosh. I was reading about this yesterday in the Trib, the very Pittsburgh holiday exhibit with the Kaufman's displays and the Macy's windows and the replica Santa chair from Kaufman's Santa Land.
Right.
And, you know, I have so many memories of going down there and enjoying the thumbprints at Arcade Bakery and taking in lunch at TikTok. I would do that every year on Light Up Night, lunch at TikTok, Arcade Bakery. And so to be able to go see those exhibits and still hold those memories is great. You know, I loved riding the wooden elevators, you know, at Christmas time with all of the lights on the on them.
And now they're incorporating the windows as well, because those are always a very special display, right?
Yes, there are some pieces that were saved from when Macy's closed. They donated them to the History Center, and so they'll be on display. Some pieces from Kaufman's from over the years, I think dating to the 60s potentially, and then also some of the Macy's windows we remember from the past couple years.
And the exhibit is named A Very Merry Christmas, and there will be, of course, classic toys on display as well. And for you fans of the movie A Christmas Story, there will be also a Red Ryder BB gun made famous by that movie as well. Okay. So lots of things, but when you've exhausted that Pittsburgh Christmas holiday nostalgia and activities, you can also experience Christmas from around the world. Of course, the nationality room's always a good thing. And at the PPG Winter Garden display, there's also the spirits of giving from around the world. This is wonderful to see how others view the holidays and how they celebrate. So it's a nice to mix the Pittsburgh traditions with how other people celebrate as well.
Reading the displays in the Winter Garden, it is always great to see how the world celebrates the holiday season, whatever their holiday and background might be.
Go ahead, Russell.
Another new thing that will be in Market Square this year, after you are done doing your shopping, if you are 21 plus, there is a bar coming to the original Oyster House. It's going to be called Miracle on Market. You might remember it last year being called Miracle on Liberty. This is a holiday-themed pop-up bar. You've got about 10 holiday-themed cocktails to choose from, and the owner tells me that it will look like Christmas threw up in there. So you've got to check it out. There are going to be decorations from floor to ceiling, as well as some really great cocktails and just a fun atmosphere for the holidays.
There better be wassail.
I'm not sure if that's on the menu, but they better.
How can
they
call
it
Christmas without wassail?
That's right.
Or at least an eggnog.
Yes, I believe there is some kind of eggnog on the menu. So you'll have to go and check it out when it opens on Black Friday.
Okay. So we have less than 2 minutes left. I want to ask you this. It's a two-part question. What is something that you won't miss, and your advice to listeners what they shouldn't miss if it's one thing? Bobby's looking at Rosalind. Bobby, you're up. What won't you miss, and what shouldn't our listeners miss?
I won't miss Kennywood Holiday Lights. That's something I will go multiple times, actually, throughout December. What's something that viewers shouldn't miss? The Nutcracker Village in Steubenville, Ohio. There's more than 150 Nutcracker on display through, I think, Black Friday through January 7th. And it's an outdoor festival at a park, public park there. It includes an Advent market, similar to our Market Square holiday market, but it's a great public art display of toy nutcrackers decorated.
All right, Rosalind, same thing. What won't you miss? And what, especially if somebody's new to Pittsburgh, what shouldn't they miss?
Well, I'm going to combine those into one, because what I won't miss is also my advice for listeners. Every year I walk through downtown and sort of take a Christmas tree tour on my own. So I'll start at the Point and check out that Christmas tree, and then walk through Market Square and take a look at that one, and then walk up to the City County building. It's just really special to be able to walk through the buildings of downtown, the glittering lights, and enjoy that with someone you care about. So that's what I'm going to do, and I hope to see you on that path too.
Rosalind Colgan is food and culture editor with The Incline, and Bobby Cherry is the local news editor for Trib Total Media. Thanks so much, and Merry Christmas to both of you.
Thank you very
much. Merry Christmas to you as well.
A couple of reminders for you. Our sister station, WYEP, is hosting its 10th annual Holiday Hootenanny at the August Wilson Center Thursday, December 7th. And another holiday tradition, the 41st annual Christmas All Request Show airs on WESA Friday, December 22nd, hosted by yours truly. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.